This is Brian Gardner, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 28th of September, 2011. Brian Gardner, Part 1.
My name is Brian Gerard Gardner. I was born in Glasgow on the 18th of February, 1945.
So you are now?
66.
What sort of childhood did you have? Where did you go to school?
I had a very happy childhood, really. My parents were very good. I was an only child, and I went to school in Glasgow to Hillhead High School, which was an interesting school. If it had been in England, it would be called a grammar school in its style. But it was state-run, but fee-paying, in the sense that the Corporation of Glasgow, that's the town council, subsidised it. So the fees were £1.19 a term in primary school and £3.09 a term in secondary school, which is probably something like a week's wages for an ordinary working man per term. So it was enough to put a lot of people off, but not the sort of fees that you would pay in a proper, fully funded public school. It gave me a very good education, I would say. And I was at the same school from the age of 5 to the age of 18 in the west of Glasgow.
Was university the obvious next step?
University was very much the obvious next step. For one thing, my father had worked as a laboratory technician in the anatomy department of the university, so I'd visited him occasionally there. And the university was only a couple of hundred yards from the school, so I went to school and university in more or less the same district. And the habit in those days in Scotland was to go to the university in your own town. Mm. It seems strange now when every child wants to get away from its parents and travel to distant parts or seek out a good course somewhere else. But in those days, the normal procedure was just to go to university in your own town. Why would you leave home where it would cost you more to live elsewhere?
How did you solve the problem of which subject to read at university?
Well, I actually applied to do maths and simultaneously applied to do, I think, engineering, like electrical engineering or something like that. The electrical engineering was a backup in case, for some reason, they didn't get into the maths course. And what actually I would do, well, the reason that I applied to do maths was because I thought it was the subject I was best at school. And I had the impression from talking to people that there were plenty of jobs for mathematicians. There probably still are, as much as for anything else, but there certainly were in those days. Anything from scientific applications to insurance actuaries and that sort of thing. So I applied to do maths, but when I went to the university careers advisory people, they said, we won't let you do maths, you've got to do maths and physics or maths and something else. I could have done maths and astronomy, for example. So I did maths and physics, and then it was a four-year course in an ancient Scottish university. They were all four-year courses, Glasgow University. And after a couple of years, there came a point at which they interviewed you to decide whether you were going to do maths or physics or combined maths and physics. And I had sat one of their term exams in which half of it was set by the professor on theoretical physics and half by another guy on more applied physics, it's theoretical maths rather, and applied maths. And I spent most of the exam doing the applied bit. I remember getting 58 out of 60 for that half, and I only had time to get 3 out of 60 in the last 20 minutes for the other bit. So when I came to the interview, I wasn't going to be a maths honours graduate, so I was told to go ahead and do physics, which I wanted to do anyway, but that time I had become more enamoured of the practical applications of physics and the fact that it allowed me to understand what was going on in the world.
So your first interest in physics came through the university, it wasn't already latent within you from an earlier part of your life?
Well, it was too, because, I mean, at school I was good at maths and science, physics in particular, so I was always half mathematician, half physicist. I mean, they're cognate subjects, really.
Yeah. And were you already showing an interest in the physics of the atmosphere?
Well, I was interested in astronomy, more perhaps than the physics of the atmosphere. And I think it was in 1957 that I joined the Junior Astronomical Society, which was a British national organisation. Patrick Moore was actually one of the leading lights, even in those days, though.
As a tutor?
No, it was an amateur organisation of people interested in astronomy. Oh. And he was, you know, the secretary or the treasurer or something like that, or possibly the president, I can't remember now. but this is before most people had ever heard of Patrick Moore. And I still got a book by Patrick Moore called The Moon or Guide to the Moon or something like that upstairs, which dates back from those days.
The early days of astronomy. Before the time that anybody actually got there?
Sort of. Well, absolutely, yes. So I was interested in astronomy and things like navigation, and which again is a mathematical subject, and positional astronomy, you know, right ascension and declination of stars and so on. I had still have an old Norton Star Atlas dating from my childhood. So it was that sort of interest. So that was not exactly an interest in the atmosphere, but an interest in environmental applications of science.
So what was your first inkling about the... You might have an interest in the Antarctic. What was your first brush with the concept of Antarctica?
I think my first brush with the concept of Antarctica was through a chap that had applied himself to go south, and that was Jim Jimison, who was also studying at Glasgow University, probably also a physics student. And he discussed it with me, and I began to take an interest in that. And then they have a thing called the Milk Round, where people like Bill Sloman and later Eric Salmon used to go around the universities giving talks, as other companies and employers did. And I went to, I think it must have been Bill Sloman's talk on Bass, and took an interest in it from then on. And then I had a colleague student who heard that I was interested in all I told him about it. And to my chagrin, he said he was interested in it too. And in fact, he doggedly mirrored my every move and applied to Bass as I did. He was helpful in one way, in that he knew somebody, or knew somebody who knew somebody, who put us in touch with a returned FID, Bill Isett, who'd been at Halley. And he very kindly laid on a slideshow for us at his home. And I think that was probably where I learnt most about what it was actually like to be on an Antarctic base. Mm. And from that moment, I was interested in applying.
So it was a slideshow that turned you on to it, was it?
Probably that was one of the... Well, that and Bill Sloman's talk, I imagine. And, of course, I went and read some books and so on. I remember when I was interviewed for the job in Bass by Joe Farman and Bill Sloman in the old office in Gillingham Street in Victoria. One of the things that they were interested in was whether you had read up on the Antarctic, because obviously they don't want somebody who's just heard about it yesterday. And the book that I had read was by Bechervais. Nobody's heard of him now, but it was about the Antarctic experiences on the other side of the continent at Mawson and Pointe Géologie and other French places, where it was distinctly windier than it is at any of our bases. So that was, I think that made them think that perhaps I'd bother to look the thing up.
Was this the point where they asked you about snow on mountaintops?
That was a question that I used to ask when I was an interviewer later on, but I don't think they asked me that particular one. They asked me about the Earth's magnetic field and how I'd measure it, and in particular they asked me if I'd... Well, I can't remember exactly what they asked me, but we got on to the topic of a proton precession magnetometer. They called it a proton vector magnetometer because they were measuring the Earth's magnetic field's vertical and horizontal components and so on. And as it happened, my excellent undergraduate course had exposed me to a proton precession magnetometer, which was exactly what they were talking about. So I probably gave a decent answer there. At the same time, I applied for two other jobs to show you that I wasn't entirely 100% committed to Bass, or perhaps I just thought reasonably I might not get the job, of course. Mm. I applied to the post office research station at Dollis Hill in northwest London, where I would have been studying what they called pulse code modulation, which turned out to be what we would now call digital telephony, which has sort of taken over the world. So I would have been in at the beginning of that. And the other job I applied for was with Deca Navigator in what was a precursor to later systems like SatNav and so on, but it was done with land-based stations, finding your position at sea with a sort of red, green and purple signals from three different stations. Interestingly, when I got the job with Bass, I wrote to these other two employers telling them that I wouldn't be accepting their jobs, because they all gave me a job, as tended to happen in those days. That wasn't due to any brilliance on my part. I think if you had the necessary qualifications, they were recruiting people. And nobody ever mentioned the duration of the of the job, apart from Bass, of course, who said it was, you know, limited because you went south for 2 years and came back and wrote up and that was it, finished. But the other two, the job was forever in principle. Bass offered me £997 a year, the post office £1,000, the Deca Navigator £1,000 a year, and the post office £871 a year. And when I came to retire, I joked that they had written back to me and said, thank you for telling us that you're going to the Antarctic. When you've finished your job with the Antarctic, do get in touch with us again and we'll reconsider our offers. And I thought I might write to them when I retired at the age of 60, but then I realised that all they had to offer me was a job at £871 a year.
Do you have any regrets about that decision?
Not to take those other jobs? Extremely not. No, I'm very, very glad that I joined Bass. I mean, what could possibly have been better than the career I had with Bass?
Apart from the extra £3, what swung you?
I think it was an opportunity of a lifetime. I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but it was what one said in an interview when asked why did you want to take this job, is the cliche that it was a way of combining something interesting and adventurous with an application of your qualification. So you weren't giving up your physics as you would have done if you'd just gone to, you know, do exciting work in some totally different field. You would still keep your CV going, but you'd have the adventure of a lifetime at the same time. They were very clear in the interview that it was there was a lot of mundane work in it. I mean, they said, how do you feel about washing dishes, for example? And I said, well, I think I've had enough academic stuff for a while. I'd be quite happy to wash some dishes. For all I know, that got me the job.
Did you get the sense it was a bit of a foregone conclusion, just a gentleman's chat, or were you being interrogated?
I was being interrogated, I think. I think they wanted to know, well, I'm sure they wanted to know because I sat on interview boards subsequently myself. They wanted to know whether the person would, A, be suitable to live on base from the personality point of view, would other people get on with him, and would he be happy in himself? And then the other side of the coin, would he be capable of carrying out the job and repair the instruments and keep them going and be diligent at the work? I mean, that's what you want to know when you're interviewing a FID, the personality on the one side and the technical on the other. We used to say when we were interviewing FIDs that if you had somebody who was pretty good on personality and adequate on technical, that would be fractionally better than someone who was more than adequate and technical, but only barely adequate in personality. In other words, we would put personality slightly ahead of technical, but only just.
What did you make of the chaps on the other side of the table?
Well, it was Joe Farman and Bill Sloman. I thought they were competent and mature and shrewd. I didn't have any reason to suspect otherwise. Bill Sloman, I could tell, was a good people person in the sense that he understood how to do an interview. I mean, for example, he got me onto something to do with my childhood and my upbringing, and I had said, by way of explanation or something, that my parents were quite old when I was born. And he said, how old? And I said, well, they were both in their 40s. And he said, for goodness sake, that's not old. And he, you know, he wanted to see if I bridled or had a sense of humour, as it were. And I said, well, you know, at least it was older than the parents of my peers, as it were, but I saw the joke, you know. Sounds like a trivial point now, but in an interview, you want to see whether the candidate, how the candidate reacts to being joked with or laughed at or what have you.
Good sense of humour.
Good sense of humour, GSOH.
Yeah, yeah. So the training, I mean, what was the job you actually applied for? Were you applying specifically for a particular post or...?
It was called a geophysicist, and it was to go to either Halley Bay, as it was called then, or Argentine Islands to do geophysical observations. To be honest, I can't remember now what it said in the advert, but I knew that I was going as a physicist. I mean, Jim Jemison, as I say, had told me what he was applying for and given me a flavour. Bill Isaac was a physicist, I think, at Halley and had done the similar sort of work, so I knew the sorts of work that was going on at Halley and Argentine Islands and what I was likely to be in for. So I applied specifically for the job of geophysicist.
But you needed more training, I guess.
Correct.
And you ended up in the Shetlands.
Well, the training was based in Edinburgh. We went to the Bast Geophysics Unit, as it was then called, which was in a little side building attached to the physics department of Edinburgh University in Drummond Street. And from there, well, Joe Farman was in charge of that unit then. And he sent us to various places for training, including Shetland. In Shetland, we went to the Lerwick Geophysical Observatory up on the hill. It's just a mile or two, maybe 3 miles out of Lerwick, up a hill, which is a MET station, meteorological station, and geophysical observatory combined. And the superintendent there at the time took us around and showed us the different instruments and gave us detailed, well, gave us all the manuals and things to read, but gave us detailed instruction on how to operate the instruments. Joe Farman in Edinburgh gave us the manuals, but he didn't really do the hands-on training, as I remember, not much anyway. He would ask questions. He would leave you to read for a bit, then come and ask you a searching question, which you would only know the answer to if you'd got to page 37, you know. But in Lerwick, we had hands-on practice at making magnetic observations with traditional instruments, where you look through a telescope at a magnet hanging on the end of a quartz fibre and all that kind of stuff. And we also were shown the Dobson spectrophotometer in Lerwick. They had one there, and we were given instruction and practice on that. Then we also went to Kew Observatory to learn how to work the angstrom perheliometer, which is another radiation instrument. And we went to Hemsby, near Great Yarmouth, to the Met Office Radio Sun Training School, where we went through a formal training in launching radio sun balloons for measuring pressure, temperature and humidity, and all the standard procedures for logging these things. This was long before the days of computers as we know them, so it was all done by hand with charts and rulers and pencils and connecting up lines on a graph and so on.
Was it fun, or did you have any second thoughts about it?
It was fun, and I didn't have any second thoughts at all. It was all a bit of a laugh. There were several of us at different stages. There were basically three of us who went around, and then we joined up with some others that were labelled as meteorologists going to the same stations.
Well, you trained with Bill, Brian Gilbert and Jim Chalmers.
That's right. And there was also Lewis Philp, who was a Met man. And I forget who else now, Dave French, perhaps? Pete Mountford, or I can't remember
which
year.
Any of those stand out as particular memories, those chaps?
Well, I remember them all. I mean, I remember Lou Philp. He was a little bit older and had been in the army, and he was a very practical, fun sort of guy, to turn his hand to anything, reliable sort of person. Brian Gilbert, of course, I remember a great deal because I wintered 2 winters with him, and he was my close colleague and companion throughout the whole of that time. So I remember him very well. I got on fine with him.
What were his qualities?
Brian Gilbert's qualities? Similar to my own in some ways, but an easygoing person, full of fun, a little bit zany, and same sort of size and weight as me, in a sense. So we were the two Brians, in a sense, almost like twins, sort of. When we were on base, there used to be a graph on the wall of people's weight. We had a big weighing machine. It was a steel yard, you know, one of these ones where you slide the little weights along the rack. And the graph on the wall had all, I think there were 12 of us on base. I can't remember if we divided evenly, but there were the Titans and the Diddy Men that were labelled, because the distribution was bimodal, to use a statistician's term for it. There were two distinct groups, the 6'6" guys who could lift one of the others under each arm, as it were, and the small lightweight ones, of which I was obviously one. I think I was about 9'4" in those days. I'm now more like 10'7", as it were, but that's just the ravages of age.
So the fact that you had a slight build, I guess, even then, that didn't go against you as far as physics were concerned, because there's a lot of physical work, isn't there?
There is quite a lot of physical work, but we were all young and fit. I mean, the physical work, I would say, a lot of it was digging snow. And, you know, a light man can dig snow just as well as a heavy man. I suppose the time when the heavy men came into their own was in stevedoring, you know, and unloading the ship. There were times, certainly, when You know, if we were in one of those cases where they're unloading gravel and sand bags and everyone gets in the line and passes it from one to the next one, you're stuck in the middle. I used to find that quite heavy going sometimes. But otherwise, that was the young and fit men are perfectly capable of doing whatever's put in their way.
Where did the radio sonde training come in?
The radio sonde training came in on base because we launched a radio sonde once a day at 8:15 in the morning. It was really a 12 GMT flight to be sent into the World Network of Meteorological Observations. And Argentine Islands was on what they called kitchen time, was GMT minus 3 hours. So it was, the flight was centred on 9 a.m. kitchen time. So we launched it, I think, at 8:15 in the morning with a hydrogen balloon in those days. I think it'd be helium now. And when we were trained, we thought we were supposed to be, the physicists would be maintaining the electronic equipment, which was called a Syntel. It was a valve, a piece of equipment. We didn't realise we were going to be met men as well as physicists. And we knew we would probably fly the flights because that's what we'd been trained to do. But what it turned out when we got on base was that we were also supposed to do meteorological observations, you know, surface observations, with reading the Stevenson screen for temperature and cloud types and heights and all that kind of stuff, which was fine, but nobody had ever trained us in that. So we did a crash course by being taken around by one of the existing met men.
Oh, the handover, you mean?
At the handover, we were taught how to you know, the difference between stratocumulus and stratus and all that kind of stuff, which was fun. But it was meant that we were quite busy when we arrived on base, more than we'd expected.
Hmm.
So that was fun.
We haven't quite got you there yet because...
Of course, we're still in Lerwick or somewhere.
We're still training, aren't we?
We are.
And I was just wondering how you found out where you were going to be sent.
Where we were to be sent in the Antarctic?
Yes, yeah.
That was quite curious, actually, because Joe Farman, who has a sort of waggish sense of humour, the plan was that two of us were to go to Argentine Islands and one to Halley Bay, because that was what was required to complete the complement at each station. And we were told by Joe Farman coming along with some manuals, some instruction books in his hand. One was a book on aurora, technical description of aurora, and he thumped Jim Chalmers on the head with that. And then he had two copies of an instruction manual and seismographs, and he thumped Brian Gilbert and me in the heads with those and didn't say a word. And we deduced from that that Brian and I were going to Argentine Islands because there was no seismograph at Halley, being on an ice shelf. And Jim Chalmers was going to Halley with the aurora, which is observed at Halley with an all-sky camera.
So you're beginning to realise that Joe Farman was not the most orthodox of men?
Not the most orthodox of men, but then I'm not the most orthodox of boys either. So we hit it off quite well.
You became friends, did you?
Indeed, we did, yes. Well, I mean, when he retired, as I pointed out in the speech that I gave, I've been trying to solve the problem of Joe for 24 years, I think, at that point, which was 40% of his life and more than half of mine. So I spent more time as a colleague of Joe's than practically anybody else in the world, really.
Tell me about the journey south.
The journey south, well, I sailed from Southampton on the Perla Dan, which was a ship chartered from Lauridsen Lines. That had, traditionally, these ships were used for taking cargo to and from Greenland and so on, from Denmark. It was registered in Esbjerg. And when we first joined, as I understand it, you're not allowed to have more than 12 passengers on board a ship, or you get yourself into a different insurance class. Mm-hmm. It costs much more in marine insurance. So they had to sign us on as supernumerary seamen. But of course, it was all in Danish, and I sometimes said that as I signed on in Danish as a sailor and never signed off again, as far as I can remember, I'm probably still in the Danish Merchant Navy. But then the same was true of the Bisco and the other ships that we sailed on. Everybody had to sign on as a seaman.
How was the voyage?
The voyage was very enjoyable. I mean, it was a bit of a holiday in a way because, you know, you were sailing through the tropics and there were, you know, strange birds landing on the ship and dolphins and flying fish and all that kind of stuff. And not a great deal to do other than eat and drink and lie about in the sunshine. There used to be the Danish crew were very good. There was a huge bosun, a mammoth great man, who would come up to you and grab you by the arm in a vice-like grip and say, "You come drink with me." And you'd say, "Yes, I'll come drink with you." In those days, I don't know if it's quite so true nowadays, the bosun on a ship had to be a powerful man because he ruled more by the threat of fisticuffs than by command, as it were. I remember one time, I think it was on the Bisco, the lamp trimmer, that was one of the posts beneath the bosun, appeared one morning with a black eye, and somebody said, "What happened to him?" Oh, he sort of fell out with the bosun, and the bosun reminded him who was in charge, you know. I'm hoping it's not like that nowadays, but I don't really know. I think that was how it was in yesteryear.
You call it Montevideo?
We called it Montevideo. Montevideo was called Montevideo because the first person that from the west that went there saw a little hill, thought it was a mountain, and said, "I see a mountain, Montevideo." There are buses to it, and even they don't call it a mountain. It's called Cerro, C-E-R-R-O, which is just the hill. So I've been up the hill in Montevideo. Yes, we did spend a few days in Montevideo. That was quite an experience in itself.
In what respect?
A very different culture. And I remember walking off by myself. I don't know how I had the temerity to do this. I wouldn't do it now. Walking off into the streets and exploring up in suburbs and whatnot, and just finding out what the place was like. And I remember trying to take a photograph of some guy in a uniform and him wagging the finger and saying, "You don't take photographs of men in uniform." But I got into a nice little conversation with him with my primitive Spanish that I'd previously picked up on a holiday in Spain. Yeah, but Montevideo was a fascinating place. I'm trying to remember when it was now, actually. It must have been when we came out. Brian Gilbert and I tried to sell some stuff that we didn't need. I had a camera and he had a pair of binoculars, and we'd already got better ones from the Falklands. And we got into a little fun game with one of these shysters who wanted to buy your camera. And I think I asked for, he wanted to know how much it was, and I asked for $265 or something like that. It was all in American dollars. And he agreed right away, and I thought, well, there's something wrong here, or someone agrees right away. So he handed me the money, and I counted it, and there was $263. It was $2 short. And I said, straightforwardly, "It's $2 short." And he took it back and said, oh, "I'm sorry," and handed me back the correct sum, except that it was only about $18 when I counted it. He'd managed to stick a couple of hundred or 250 or something like that into his pocket. And so I think we were lucky to get away with our lives. We still had our cameras at the end of it. And somebody else tried to do the same on the Bisco. They came on board the Bisco and did the same trick, and had to run for it, trying to buy somebody's radio off them and so on. So it's a fun place, Montevideo, and anywhere else in South America, but you have to keep your wits about you.
So did Port Stanley seem rather more civilised when you got there?
Port Stanley is civilised in a different way. Port Stanley is... I don't know if everyone would describe Port Stanley as civilised. In those days, it was... it was a very small place in a way. I mean, there were only 2,000 people on the islands, 1,000 in Port Stanley and 1,000 out in the camp. They called it the camp, all the sheep stations out there. Mm. I think because it's short for campesino, which was the original Spanish word for the bandu, as it were, out there. So there was a lot of buildings with corrugated iron roofs and that sort of thing. So it was another little special place on its own, a very tiny enclosed community where everyone knew everyone else, and they all knew what each other were up to and so on. So it was far from being civilized in the sense of Paris, say, or something like that, but civilized in some ways, I agree, compared to Montevideo. You were less likely to be mugged in Stanley than you were in Monte, I think.
What happened to you there? You had to prepare yourself even further to go south.
In Stanley, in those days, whereas nowadays we kit everyone out in Bath and Cambridge, in those days it was all done in Stanley. There was a Stanley office run by Miriam, the unreplaceable, irreplaceable Miriam Booth, I think her name was.
Booth?
Was it Booth?
You tell me.
I think it was Miriam Booth. I just know her as Miriam. I think it was Booth. Everyone knows her anyway. And they had a clothing store there. The thing that I remember about that was that on the list of kit, you were supposed to get 3 pairs of army battle dress trousers, or trousers, comma, battle dress, flannel, as it were, which were warm. I was asked for my waist measurement, which was 30 inches in those days. They said, we haven't got any 30s. We've got 1 pair of 32s, and we can give you 2 pairs of 34s. So I spent the next 2 years with trousers that had to be tightly held up with a belt, as it were, because they were 4 inches too big for me. Although I did spend quite a bit of my time on base wearing jeans anyway.
And you set off south then, this time on the Shackleton, I think, is that right?
That's right. I spent about a week in Stanley in the inimitable Ship Hotel. I can never remember whether it started as the Ship and became the Upland Goose or the other way around, but it was that hotel. That was quite fun. I mean, it was, you talk about civilised, it was pretty uncivilised in some ways, and there were there was no lock on our bedroom door, there were people fighting with knives in the corridor in the middle of the night, so they were probably not from the Falklands. I dare say they were just seamen that had landed, but it was a fun place. So I spent a week in the Ship Hotel, and then we got on the Shackleton, which was 1,100 tons. It's quite a small ship compared to some of the others. And we set off across the Drake Passage to the peninsula. We spent a little, I can't remember how long, but probably about a week or so, traipsing up and down between Elephant Island and Clarence Island, jocularly referred to as the Elephant and Castle. So you'd look out of the porthole and you'd see Elephant Island, and then we'd turn around and look out half an hour later, and you'd be going back up to Clarence again, doing geophysical surveying, marine surveying of some kind.
And then, were you involved in that, or were you just simply confused passenger?
A confused passenger. And then we eventually made our way down to Argentine Islands. I've got a vague feeling that we called in at one or two places on the way, I think Port Lockroy, but it was uninhabited. These were visits where they sometimes went to an old station to see whether it needed, you know, repair or boarding up or that sort of thing.
So you did 2 seasons at Adelaide, Argentine.
Argentine Islands. I did 2 years at Argentine Islands. I arrived at Argentine Islands, I think in mid-January 1968, having sailed from Southampton in November 67. And then I finally left Argentine Islands, it would be in January 1970 then, 2 years later.
Was it as good as Bill Isett's slides had led you to believe?
Well, Bill Isett's slides were of Halley Bay. So it was a very, very different place. Halley Bay was your vast expanse of white ice shelf, and everything in those days was quite buried because the old base was well down. So that was one form of existence. Argentine Islands was completely different. It was a wooden hut, or several wooden huts, built on rock, and with a beautiful, what you might call alpine scenery, looking across to the mainland with pink sunsets on the glaciers and all that kind of stuff. So Argentine Islands was a beautiful place compared to the boring expanse of Halley. Of course, the Halley people see it a different way and see it as the true south, and Argentine Islands as being somewhere up the banana belt.
You were happy there?
I was very happy there. Argentine Islands is at 65 and a quarter degrees south, so it's not quite over the Antarctic Circle. And I think it was my first summer there, maybe it was after a year, we had a tourist ship. Well, I think it was possibly the first tourist ship to come down, a Russian ship, I think, with Americans on board. And I remember them, when they left us, saying, we're going down to cross the circle, the Antarctic Circle, at 66 and a half south. But they were back within about 12 hours, and there was no way they got to the Antarctic Circle, although they were told that they had, because the ship's captain, had a sceptical view of sea ice and didn't want to go any further than he absolutely needed to.
Was this the Navarino?
It might well have been the Navarino, yes.
Yeah.
And that would be in the 68-69 season then.
Were you surprised to see tourists floating around the Antarctic?
Well, as I say, I think they were the first tourists either to come to the Antarctic or to come to our station, certainly. Probably the first tourists in the Antarctic at all, I think, maybe, in that sense. We were surprised. I remember one chap on base, Richie Hesbrook, one of the Titans, a 6'6" guy from Church Stretton in Shropshire, farmer's son, but trained as a polymer chemist. He was surprised in more ways than one, because with a number of people on base, with some extra people in the changeover, the bunk rooms were full, and he'd got up into the loft to sleep, and it was quite hot up there, so he was naked. And he sort of swung down with his great strong muscles out of the hatch, only to find himself staring at a woman coming off the ship up the corridor, and had to do an athletic leap back up into the loft again. And I think it was he who said to me that he was slightly disappointed that there were tourists, because he'd wanted to be able to say that he hadn't seen a woman for 2 years, and unfortunately I think she came halfway through his term. And maybe it was in the season when I arrived, actually, in the early 68, but it would be halfway through his 2 years. That's probably right.
So you were even more surprised that these tourists came to your base to have a look around?
Well, it was a natural thing for them to do, because if you were a shipping company planning tourism, you would naturally go down the peninsula because it's beautiful and accessible more than anywhere else. And you would naturally want to go to a base that was occupied to be able to see what was going on. So it was natural for them to come to Argentine Islands. They had to come down through Lemaire Channel, which is a beautiful place to take photographs of and so on. So I think it was understandable that they came to us, and equally understandable that they didn't want to go any further south if they could avoid it. I mean, where else could they go if they wanted to come to a British base, say? There were no others. Deception, I suppose. It had its own problems.
You and Brian Gilbert took over from a couple of guys called Morgan and Mitchell.
Yes, Dave Morgan and Dave Mitchell.
So it's Dave and David plays by
Brian. Or was it Peter? I've forgotten now, to be honest.
I can look
Mitchell and Morgan, yes.
Don't worry. What sort of state was the equipment in?
This equipment was in fine repair, no problem there. We had quite a lot of programmes to run. We had the geomagnetic instruments in the what we called the magnetic hut, though strictly speaking it's the non-magnetic hut. That was about a quarter of a mile from base, still on the same island, on Galindi's Island. And everything is made out of copper nails instead of iron nails and so on. And no metal work to disturb the magnetic field. We had that to run. We had a seismograph near the base, attached to the base. We had radiation instruments sitting on the Braithwaite fuel tank and others over the snow. We had a tide gauge in a creek. We had to take samples of snow for analysis for radioactive isotopes. And I can't remember what else. Well, we had the whole MET program, of course, of surface and upper air observations. And, of course, we had the ozone measurements to make 5 times a day and more on sunny days, and all their calibrations and so on.
Do you know why you were taking ozone measurements?
Well, in those days, ozone was being measured not for what you would think of now as looking for chemical pollution or anything like that. The original program, which started in the International Geophysical Year, IGY, in 1957-58, was there because of the interest in ozone from the atmospheric physics point of view, because ozone absorbs not only ultraviolet light, which everybody knows, but it also absorbs a small percentage of visible light as well. Fortunately, not too much, or we'd be in the dark here. But it does absorb some visible light and UV, and it warms the layer of the atmosphere where you find the ozone, which we call the stratosphere. And because it warms the air there, that means that instead of the air getting cooler as you go up, which it does in the lower atmosphere, in the troposphere, in the stratosphere, it stays steady for a bit and then gets warmer as you go up. And if you have the air at the same temperature as you go up, or if it's getting warmer as you go up, it's very stable. It's difficult to get convection going. And so the air is stratified in horizontal layers, hence the name the stratosphere. And that kind of puts a lid on top of the troposphere. The troposphere is the lowest layer where you get all the convective clouds, cumulus and cumulonimbus and so on, and all your weather takes place in the troposphere. And the troposphere goes up to typically 15 kilometres in most parts of the world, but rather less, more like 10 kilometres in polar regions. Above that, you've got the stratosphere going from that, from the top of the troposphere up to 50 kilometres, 50. And the interest in those days was that the stratosphere therefore sat as a sort of limiting layer on top of the troposphere. And unless you understood the dynamics of the stratosphere, you couldn't understand the whole of the atmosphere, even from the meteorological point of view. So Professor Dobson, the grand old man of ozone measurement from the atmospheric physics department in Oxford, decided, well, he built this instrument, an ultraviolet spectrometer for measuring ozone, and he built it with the intention of getting measurements from all over the world to understand the what we call the climatology of ozone, that's to say how it's distributed in latitude, in longitude, if there is a difference, and in season, and how it varied from year to year. And he got instruments installed all over the world and got everyone to send their answers, their measurements back on postcards to his house in Oxford, where he collated them and made graphs of them and began to understand how the ozone varies around the world. Very dedicated man, Gordon Miller Bourne Dobson.
No, I guess you couldn't send yours back on, your measures back by postcard.
We sent ours back by telegram,
by
signal. Yes, I mean, to begin with, of course, communications up until about the time that I was south in the 60s were all done by Morse. So it was telegrams where the wireless op was going on his Morse key. But it was a fantastic innovation, you might say, in 1968 when I arrived at Argentine Islands. We had a chap called Bob Davidson who'd been sent down. He was actually seconded from the Royal Air Force, where I think he'd been a radar mechanic, but he was installing new radio equipment, RTTY, radio teletype, which was essentially a teleprinter operating through radio. And from that point on, a lot of our numerical data was sent out to Stanley on the radio teletype.
So how are those early measurements taken? You're measuring the thickness of the ozone layer, and you were using balloons, or?
No, we were doing it from the ground with this Dobson ozone spectrophotometer.
So you're sending signals?
No, it's quite passive. You look at sunlight. So, for example, if you've got a nice bright sunny day, you put a tube on top of the instrument with a prism which acts as a mirror and get the sunlight to shine straight down the tube into the instrument. The instrument is about 5 or 6 feet long. It's a big aluminium box full of prisms and mirrors and lenses. And it basically takes the sunlight, focuses it, and then puts it through a prism to disperse, you know, to form a spectrum, to disperse the colours. And then it ignores the visible light, which it's not interested in, and selects the ultraviolet portion of the spectrum by shining it through a little slit in a barrier. And you can select different wavelengths of ultraviolet, that's different colours of ultraviolet. And the reason you do that is that ozone absorbs ultraviolet light, but it absorbs the shorter wavelengths of ultraviolet light much more strongly than the longer wavelengths. So, for example, at a wavelength of 300 nanometres, ozone absorbs quite strongly, but at 340 nanometres, which is longer, it doesn't absorb quite so strongly. So if you look at two different wavelengths, you can tell whether there's a lot of ozone in the atmosphere because the shorter wavelength will be more reduced, more attenuated. And Dobson designed this instrument very cunningly and cleverly so that it would measure ozone and nothing else. He carefully measured pairs of wavelengths and pairs of wavelengths to eliminate all the other factors that didn't vary with wavelength. And so we several times a day, we climbed a vertical ladder in the corridor up into the ozone loft. It was up in a loft so that you could see the sky clearly without any obstructions. And you had to make a measurement by adjusting the wavelength that you were looking at, the wavelength pair, and recording the amount of ultraviolet that you receive in the instrument.
So there was a hatch in the roof, was it?
There was a hatch in the roof, yes. You can make measurements even when there's no sun. You can make measurements on the zenith cloud, just looking at the cloud directly above you. Because on sunny days, when the sun and cloud, you make a sunny observation and a cloudy observation. And over a period of time, you build up charts that enable you to say what it would have been had it been sunny. The cloudy observations are not quite as good in quality as the sunny ones, because the sunny, direct sun observations are calculable. You can actually calculate the amount of ozone because you know what's coming in from the sun. Whereas the cloud, you're not quite sure how thick the cloud is and how it's behaving. But the difference in ozone absorption still shows up in the cloud at different wavelengths. So the sun, direct sun observations are the best and the only really accurate ones, but the cloud observations are pretty good second best. And in fact, at most, well, at many stations around the world, there are far more cloudy observations than there are sunny ones, obviously.
And you were simply just, apart from morsing them off to Oxford, you were making notes locally, you were writing down charts, noting down the measurements on a chart.
We were sending them not to Oxford in those days, but to Edinburgh, where Joe Farman was based.
Right.
We sent them to our bus unit. Apart from that, we were mostly measuring. We didn't spend much time graphing them. We were, our task really was to make good measurements, make them accurately, maintain the instruments, do all the calibrations. There are lots of calibrations you have to do in an ozone instrument. Mm. Monthly lamp tests to see that the instrument's performing. There were lots of graphs of those, but we weren't really charged with studying the atmosphere. That was for the folks back home to do. And so it was for many years, in fact.
Second year, your team was increased to three.
Second year, our team was increased to three. We had, I think in the first year, we had two physicists and three or four MET men, I can't remember now. And then the second year, we took on Alan Woods, a third physicist, and I can't remember how many MET men we had. But that meant that our onerous task of being MET men for half the time was shared a little bit more. Mm. So that was slightly eased our workload.
I'd have to ask you about Six-Gun Diamond and hiding behind the stove. What's that all about?
Six-Gun Diamond, he was the outgoing wireless operator when I first arrived. This was in my first few days or the first week or two. I arrived in mid-January, and I think the last people probably left in March, so it could be any time in that period. I think the incident you're referring to was that in those days, of course, we had dogs on base, mainly for breeding. They weren't really used for field work from Argentine Islands. And we had to shoot seals for the dogs. As I remember, we had to shoot something like four seals per dog per year. So with 12 or 15 dogs or something like that, we probably had about 50 or 60 seals to shoot in the summer season. And a couple of FIDs were out there, one of them being Robin Diamond. One with a rifle and the other, for some reason, with a revolver or a pistol. I have no idea why. It was probably totally unsuitable and sounds horrifying now. But for some reason, they got onto a floe that was turning around, an ice floe, and they didn't realise what direction they were pointing in. And I found myself in the corridor near the kitchen and the ionospheric room, the beastie room, and you could hear ricochets going, whing! And the outgoing base commander, Brian Swift, who's known as Speedy, who was also a sergeant in the Royal Air Force, seconded. He was crouching down in the beastie room and saying to anyone that would listen, am I in line with the stove? The stove in the kitchen was one of these huge, great metal things. I would call it an aga, but I'm told it's actually an essa. And he was crouching down behind this. He said, am I in line with the stove? Because he wanted to avoid these flying rounds, and I thought, if it's good enough for an RAF sergeant, it's good enough for me, so I crouched down beside him. That was over quite quickly. So the Robin Diamond was then known as Six-Gun Diamond. He used to communicate with a Japanese station somewhere who used to respond to his every comment with, Lodger, Lodger, Lobin.
Can I talk to you a bit about Ken Portwine?
Ken Portwine, yes.
Who became seriously ill, sadly, whilst he was with you.
That's
what memories do you have of that period?
Ken Portwine was slightly older than the rest of it. I think he was about 31, whereas most people on bass were in their early 20s. So he was a cook in my first year until he fell ill. He had been a cook at a youth hostel in the Lake District, I think, Copper Mines or something like that. And I got on with him fine. I mean, some people didn't get on with him so well because he was a little bit paternalistic, thinking of himself as slightly older than more experienced. I didn't mind that. He was older and more experienced than me in some aspects of life, so I accepted that. But he had ulcerative colitis or some such disease involving his innards, and he was confined to bed probably from about midwinter, or I can't remember exactly, but quite early on anyway. And I think it was said that he had some signs of this illness before he went south and hadn't admitted to it, but I don't know if that's correct. Anyway, he took up quite a lot of time in the care that he needed once he was confined to bed.
Were you on that nursing rota?
I wasn't on the nursing rota, no. But, of course, we all had to take turns at cook because we didn't have a cook anymore. I remember he was still perfectly compos mentis and communicative, and you could go into him in his bed and have a chat with him, which we did a lot, to give him company, of course, because he was sitting on his own there. And he would give me guidance as to what to cook, because naturally, cooking for 12 guys in a base, you need help. So that was... I got on fine with Ken Portwine. And then, of course, the story developed because I think the British authorities approached the Argentines for help to try and get him evacuated. And the first thing that happened was that a small plane, I think it was a single-engine Beaver, came across from Matienzo. Teniente Matienzo was an Argentine station on the Larsen Ice Shelf on the other side of the mountain range, the other side of the peninsula. And it landed on Skua Island, I think, in our group of islands, something that nobody had ever done before. He just flew around a few times and landed. The captain, who was called Julio Luján, L-U-J-A-N, was one of those, I think probably in his 50s, one of those experienced pilots who drives an aircraft the way you and I would drive a car. You know, you could get it through tight spots and you've got used to it and you're fully in command of the vehicle, as it were. And he could land practically anywhere. And he arrived. They eventually shifted the plane onto the sea ice when they determined that the sea ice was thick enough to land on. Now, this was in, I think, probably July or August of 1968 or thereabouts. And there were four of them in the plane. There was the captain, we eventually called him Mad Dan Luján, and his co-pilot, who was about 25, Captain, he'd be Lieutenant Jose Pozzi, and an air mechanic called Oscar Jose Pozzi. Was it called Oscar? That's right. Oscar Jose Pozzi. And the air mechanic was called Jose Diaz. And then the fourth person was the doctor that they brought with them, their own doctor, who again was an experienced man, middle-aged, called Elicio Iturrieta. And I got to know him very well. He was an intelligent and interesting man to talk to. I remember one conversation with him in which we spoke mostly in his very good English and a little bit in my very bad Spanish. And we were discussing something to do with the differences between our cultures. And we were talking about identity cards, and he was talking about the documentation that you had to carry about everywhere with you. And I said, well, we don't actually have to carry anything about with us in Britain. And he said, well, you know, whatever it is you have to carry, you may not call it an identity card or a passport, but whatever documentation you have to carry, said the doctor. And I said, well, we don't have to carry anything. And it took me most of the evening to persuade him that we didn't carry ID. And he said to me at one point, well, what if a policeman stops you and wants to know who you are? I said, well, he just asks you for your name and address. And he fell about laughing. And he seriously couldn't believe me for quite a while. He thought I was pulling his leg or misunderstanding.
Ken's condition didn't improve, did it?
It didn't.
Kind of pall that fell over the base?
The doctor was very good. He did blood transfusions from people on base and so on.
Including you?
Not including me, you know. I can't remember why now. I volunteered, but either I was the wrong group or I was the wrong weight or something like that. But he did, I think he did do blood transfusions from somebody on base. And eventually they decided that they'd shift Ken to Esperanza, the more northerly Argentine base, where he could be reached by ship. That was the plan. And so the base commander then, John Dudney, got in the plane with the two pilots and the doctor. The air mechanic stayed behind, and they were setting off from sea ice, and I was standing beside the air mechanic, Jose Diaz, as the plane took off, and it was foggy. But the fog only went up so high, and the pilot was quite sure that he would get out of the fog in a minute. But in fact, the fog, as I understand it, I think it was probably a petrol-driven plane, an avgas plane, and the fog got into the carburetor or something like that, and he lost power, couldn't gain altitude. And to save himself, he went round in a big arc and crash-landed the plane in a tide crack, but not before he had hit the wing on an iceberg. The plane was painted red, as everything is in the Antarctic, and he left red paint on one of the icebergs. You could see it after he'd passed there. He landed in a tide crack. I think it was in the Three Little Pigs, which are three little islands, part of the Argentine Islands group. And the tide crack was a bit wet, as tide cracks often are. Mm-hmm. And the young pilot was so anxious that he stretched himself across this wet gap to let Ken Portwine walk across him, really, to safety. And then they then all started getting their clothes off and drying themselves over a Primus out of the plane, while the captain, Mad Dan, as we came to know him, radioed, "Emergencia, emergencia," and so on. And our radio op, of course, was still listening as the plane had been taken off. So everybody then wanted to go out and try and find them and rescue them. We were going to turn the rowing boats. They were all upside down for the winter. But then we heard that they were in a tide crack on sea ice. So they went off with a sledge, and most of the base went off like that. But I stayed behind with Bob Davidson, the radio mechanic, and Tony Feenan, the wireless op. And they set up a portable radio, a rather ancient old, I think it was called a 68 set. Mm. And I took that on a sledge, went off some minutes behind the main crowd. But when I was about halfway out, they were so quick, they found them quite easily, brought them all back, and I met them coming back, so we all went back together. So we didn't need the radio after all. I was hoping that if they'd got lost and couldn't find them, I could at least make some radio connection to find out where they were. Because we didn't know if they'd drowned or been killed or anything, you know. All we knew was that Mad Dan was calling on the radio for help. But nobody was injured. They all came back within an hour or so. And I remember the captain, Julio Lacan, saying that the young pilot, Oscar, was quite shaken. He said, "It's his first crash, it's my ninth." And it turned out that Captain Lacan's nose was largely made of plastic or something like that because of previous crashes he'd been in. He regarded this as just another routine event.
So you still had Ken Portwine?
We still had Ken Portwine. That's right. The next thing that happened was that the Argentine government, great credit to them, took their icebreaker, the Rompehielos General San Martin, General San Martin. They got it out of mothballs in the winter, set it up to sail, and they sailed to Esperanza, I think. And then they sent helicopters. I'm not sure. They probably sailed further south to some spot in the middle of the ocean where they met the sea ice. And then they sent a couple of quite large helicopters. And that was quite fun as well, because you light flares. This was in daylight. And you send red smoke from one end of a flare. And you could see these two helicopters as little dots on the horizon, moving slightly sideways across the horizon. As soon as you light the flares, they stopped, because they're now coming towards you, because the only way they could find us was by spotting these red smoke clouds in the distance. And they came in. And then I remember marshalling one of them in. I think I've discovered later that that was because Oscar, the young pilot, was marshalling a helicopter in and walking backwards on the snow as he marshalled him in, and he stepped backwards over a cliff Fortunately, we discovered later, nobody knew where he'd gone. He emerged safe and sound, but he'd landed in deep, soft snow. But I had to marshal one of these helicopters in to our designated landing place. Probably the only chance I would ever have got to marshal an Argentine naval helicopter.
So who was it fell over the ice cliff? Posey?
Oscar Posey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Then Ken, of course, died shortly afterwards, didn't he, sadly?
So then the Argies took him out to BA, to Buenos Aires, where he died in hospital. The details I have no idea about. And that was the end of that sad story.
What other, apart from that episode, which is a long, prolonged episode, one gets the impression that was actually quite a good season for you.
I would say it was, yes. I mean, it was good in many respects. Actually, the Ken Portwine incident, although tragic and disastrous in many ways, probably pulled the base together in a way that nothing else could, because you all had to cooperate, and as I say, we're all taking turns of being cook and all sorts of things like that. And the events were exciting and stimulating, even if disastrous. And so it was an interesting year, to put it mildly. We also had quite good sea ice that year, and so we got to do one or two trips after this was all over. There was a sense of relief on base, of course, when he went. We didn't know he'd died until later. And with good sea ice, we got some trips to surrounding places.
Mount Scott?
Yes, I went on a trip to Peterman Island, which is about 6 miles north of Argentine Islands, and we spent a day going up Mount Scott. We'd intended to get to the top, but I think halfway up the cloud manked in a bit, and being reasonably prudent, we decided not to push our luck, and we came back down again. I ended up, we came down on skis with skins on to easier for getting up and slow you down a bit coming down. I remember stopping at one point for a breather and somebody saying, "I don't want to alarm you, but you've just stopped on a snow bridge over a crevasse." They'd just seen sideways where there was a crevasse. So I sort of gingerly moved myself gently forward. But that's the sort of thing that happens, of course, and the difference between an amusing story and a catastrophe is rather close.
Did you do much travelling, or were you...
No.
Because I guess a lot of time was spent fulfilling your commitment to do these measurements, these readings.
That's right, yes. I think the other place that I remember going to was the penguin colony on the Jalur Islands, which is sort of halfway between Argentine Islands and the mainland. But apart from that, everyone took their turn at the occasional forays, but there wasn't an awful lot of travelling done. Sea ice has to be pretty good for you to travel on anyway. It's a dangerous stuff at the best of time.
You were the fire officer for the base, and fire is always a big worry, isn't it?
It is, yes. There hadn't been a fire drill for quite a while, so I felt I was doing pretty well when I managed to get them to do one fire drill. Nowadays, of course, you probably, with health and safety, they quite correctly do them on a much more regular basis. But mostly my duties involved going round all the fire extinguishers, of which we had plenty of 3 or 4 different kinds, powder and carbon dioxide and water and what have you, and checking that they were all still functioning properly, and basically by weighing them. And the other duty, I suppose, was to remind people of fire safety, and to... We had a lot of coal fires, and you had to make sure that people didn't overbuild them up so that hot embers would roll out onto the floor and things like that.
So you had a few close calls?
No, we didn't really, I would say. No. I don't think we had any close calls. But as you say, it is a very dangerous business, living in wooden huts with bitumastic roofs and so on, and very little opportunity to put a fire out once it gets hold.
Do you get many visits? I think you had the Endurance came through with some helicopters at one point.
The Endurance did. I can't remember much about the helicopters on the Endurance and at Argentine Islands.
Bringing your new cook for Christmas.
Oh, bringing the new cook for Christmas. Did he come in a helicopter? You're probably right. He told you that himself, I think. Yes, I remember the Endurance coming in.
The new cook was Alan Weirden, was it?
The new cook was Alan Weirden, yes. Yes, because Ken Portwine, who died, was the cook, it was understood by the hierarchy that Argentine Islands needed a cook. And, of course, just as an army marches in its stomach, FIDs do as well. And the bosses in in London probably realised that it would be prudent to get a cook in as soon as possible. So they arranged for Alan Weirden to come in on the endurance. Alan Weirden, it goes without saying, is one of the best cooks that Fids had ever had. He was excellent.
No, it doesn't go without saying. Explain to me why he was so good.
Well, he just was very good. I just remember his food being excellent. And he was very, very hardworking. And, I mean, Fids are typically very critical. You know, I mean, the old saying, which is probably borrowed from the armed forces, was, it starts with, who called the cook a bastard? Who called the bastard a cook? You know, people are notoriously critical of cooks, but nobody was critical of Alan Weirden. He was excellent. I remember one time he, probably a midwinter feast or something like that would be his pièce de résistance. And after all the main starter and the main course and the pudding and whatnot, he produced what he told us was done in the best hotels, a little savoury after the pudding, which was sooty kidneys turbigo. I haven't forgotten that. But he made wonderful cakes and fascinating bread and everything you could possibly ask for of a cook. And a very nice guy as well.
What's all this about the new Twin Otter on the Larsen? Some sort of radio communication with that?
That, I think, is a reference to Captain Derek Smith. Was that his name? No, I can't remember. I think what happened was that his aircraft, he was setting off from Adelaide, probably, to get to Fossil Bluff. and you've got to remember there are no navigational aids to speak of in those days. And I think what happened was he went south. He couldn't get to Fossil Bluff because it was clouded in or something like that, and he had a crosswind. A crosswind of only about 10 knots can shift you a long way in a journey of several hours. And I think it shifted him sideways on the way south to Fossil Bluff, and it shifted him further sideways eastwards on the way back, so that when he came back to Adelaide, he couldn't find Adelaide. And we now know that that was because he was on the eastern side of the peninsula on the Larsen Ice Shelf. But he didn't know that, and Adelaide didn't know that. And we were listening on the radio to all this happening. And I remember as he was coming into land, running short of fuel, he said, I'm going to have to land on the sea ice. And he landed in the sea ice and said, to conserve battery power, the Adelaide wireless op said to him, so tell me, he said, when you get out, how thick is the sea ice? He said, one dit for each foot. And he went, you know, this is in Morse. And you would see, the way to do this is you would ask a question and say one dit for yes and two dits for no. So he'd say something like, have you landed safely? One dit yes, two dits no. Beep. Are you on sea ice? One dit yes, two dits no. Beep. Then how thick is the sea ice? One dit for each foot. Beep, 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 beep. Because they couldn't get through their chisel through the sea ice because they were on the Larsen Ice Shelf, which was hundreds of feet thick. And I remember this was squadron leader, I think it was, squadron leader Derek Smith or something Smith. And eventually, of course, he had run out of fuel. They told him that there was a depot at Cape Agassiz that had been left there donkeys years ago, and he managed to make that short journey and found the fuel depot, I think, or maybe he didn't, I can't remember now. But anyway, the Endurance was asked to come down and help and came down and got to Adelaide, and they were going to fly helicopters, but the weather, it's quite difficult to helicopters across a 10,000-foot pass or something like that across the mountains. And I think they made a couple of attempts that weren't successful because the weather went against them, but the third time they got across with fuel to Squadron Leader Smith. And we heard them on the radio saying, yes, we've fueled them up now. It was terribly, terribly public school. And we expect we'll be back in time for tea. To this day, I don't know whether they were putting that on or not. I don't think so.
So did he fly out again?
They brought fuel to him and he flew out again. And all was well. Otherwise, he'd have been marooned there for quite a long while, which would have been embarrassing, to put it mildly.
Gosh, and you were listening to all that on the radio?
We were listening to all that on the radio. The whole peninsula was listening to it on the radio.
Gosh, how exciting. Shall we take a break?
We shall take a break.